Hello and welcome to the yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 22nd of May 2016. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Web Cowgirl, and Phil from the West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about The Flick at the Dorfman at the National Theatre. This is Annie Barker's Pulitzer Prize-winning play that has come to us from America, written in 2013. It's directed by Sam Gold and concerns a rundown movie theatre in central Massachusetts. I have to say, they can be rather soulless. I went to one recently which was half empty, and yes, it took something away from me, so it must take something away from underpaid employees who have to clean up afterwards. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, it's clearly a play. If you read the reviews, which are all virtually five-star reviews, you'd think this was a universally acclaimed play. But there's a big difference between that and, I think, the audience reaction, which is much more divided. And, I mean, you tell that just by sitting in the theatre, by the number of people that don't come back in the second half. And I think part of that, well, I think that's mostly to do with the length and the pace, because it is 3.25 hours long, and the play does have a relatively slow pace. But I'm one of the people that likes it, so I'm in the positive camp. And if you read the program in advance, as I did, you'd kind of be expecting a play about the transition from 35mm film to digital and the sort of negative consequences of that. And that is indeed the backdrop to the play, but actually the play is much more about the relationships between the three principal characters and the backstories of two of those three characters. And in that sort of fairly long playing time, every scene actually takes place in the cinema auditorium between screenings, or indeed at the end of the day, as the three cinema staff are cleaning between the rows and talking amongst themselves. And we do occasionally get a glimpse into the projection room, but we only get that through small windows high up on the back wall. And there is a lot of silence, probably more silence than you get in a Harold Pinter play. But the strength of the play for me is in the characterizations, really, because the people really are fascinating and very real. And at the beginning, I wasn't sure I would be staying the length, to be honest. But then it really does kind of draw you in and kind of will captivate you, I think. And it was the people rather than the technological change that is the captivating thing about the play, because you learn quite a lot about them, you peer into their lives in a kind of voyeuristic way, really. And I didn't feel the length at all, to be honest, because I was really quite enthralled by the whole thing. The only other play of hers I've seen, and possibly the only other play of hers we've had here, is Circle Mirror Transformation, which the Royal Court did, and the Royal Court sent us to a sports centre in Haggerston to see it. And for this, the National Theatre have actually built a 110-seat cinema on the Dorfman stage, which is simply uncanny. I mean, it is really an extraordinary piece of design, I think. The performances, two of the lead roles, there are three lead roles, really. Matthew Maher and Louise Krauss have come over from the Broadway production, and they play Sam and Rose respectively, and I think they're both absolutely outstanding. But the third, who is a young British actor called Jagan Ahe, is also absolutely terrific. He plays the third character, Avery. There's a much smaller, well, two much smaller roles, supporting roles, which are played by another British actor called Sam Heron, but those are the three main roles. It does divide people. There were a lot of empty seats after the interval, but I actually kind of surprised myself really by not being one of them. I actually did find it, like most of the reviewers are saying, a very sort of captivating experience that really draws you in, and I can see what all the fuss is about, really. So it's something that I would recommend, but I would warn people that they may feel it slow, particularly at the beginning, but they need to, you know, have tolerance to stay with something for 3.25 hours and to give it a go. But I can see why those that left, but I wasn't one of them, and I would recommend it, I think.
So, Web Cowgirl, what do you think about The Flick?
It's really interesting to go see an American play that wholly embraces the entire sort of Pinteresque concept of silences, because so much of The Flick is waiting. It's waiting for people to talk, waiting for a conversation to happen, waiting sometimes for people to come back onto the stage, waiting for things to happen that you think you're going to see and that frequently don't happen. The pacing is almost supernaturally slow. And yet, unlike Pinter, the feeling that you get isn't that the people you are watching are sitting there with their brains racing, desperately coming up with all of these sneaky plans of what they're going to be doing. In fact, the pauses in the pacing of this show, to me, are an enforced, a painfully enforced naturalism that relates to the characters, the lives that they're leading, the conversations they would honestly have. And in no way are these pauses meant to sort of imply that massive criminal behavior is being planned by dastardly criminals who are going to execute acts of unspeakable violence upon the other people. It is a play really, really rooted in a naturalistic style, and it's difficult to adjust to that because so much of our experience of play going, play watching is things happen and everything keeps upon like a really snappy pace. And you don't wait for conversations to happen. You don't wait for people to make up their minds for, you know, any more than say 45 minutes or an hour, or God forbid 2 hours and 10 minutes. And the naturalism, the realism of this play, the realisticness of it is one of the greatest things to treasure about the flick, because the flick feels more real than pretty much almost any play I can remember seeing, except for maybe the other play that Annie Baker did, Circle Mirror Transformation, which didn't bother trying to make people playing actors be interesting or fascinating and made them just as boring as they are in real life. So Flick came with really strong recommendations for me, and I just bought the ticket because, frankly, I'm always up for seeing a Pulitzer Prize. But one of the recommendations that I saw for it was that this was the millennial play. And I feel this play does very much capture the experience of being in your early 20s and not knowing where your life is going, but also capture the feeling of where America is right now. First of all, talking about the whole 20-something experience, I utterly believed in these three characters who were working dead-end jobs and found their lives didn't really seem to have that much meaning. And so they attempted to make some meaning for themselves by doing things like having late-night movie sessions, playing little games with each other while they were working together, maybe falling in and out of love with each other, basically acting like human beings. But the concept that this play simply represented what it was like to be a millennial these days, to be sort of thinking you know everything, but realizing the world isn't really going to be such an exciting place, and lowering your expectations appropriately. To be honest, it's not realistic to say that this is something exclusive to the 20-somethings of this generation. I speak as a member of Generation X, and people may have forgotten, but the reason why we got our name was because a little book came out in which all of us realized that we had gone to uni, and in fact, we weren't going to change the world. We weren't going to have incredibly exciting jobs. We were going to do mostly very stupid things and just get by, and we were going to have to struggle to find meaning in a world in which it was just not as exciting as we'd hoped it would be. And the three characters of the flick all seem to realize that. But more interesting is the question of to what extent this play is representing American society as it is nowadays, because I think people are beginning to realize, and millennials especially, but all of us, well, all of us Americans, that the good old days have gone, that the chances for having work that is almost anything besides menial, boring, repetitive, uninspiring, this may actually be all that we have anymore. Even the decent jobs, the manufacturing jobs, have left. And in the case of at least two of the characters of the flick, you found that going to uni really wasn't making that much of a difference in terms of them getting ahead in life. Being a good worker made no difference to them getting ahead of life. There was just not that much to look forward to. And I think as we are moving into the 21st century, America and Americans are starting to face up to the fact that we are never going to have what we used to have. The good old days are gone. Although, of course, for people who actually have enough money to go to the theater, you may not be so close to realizing that there's a giant wave of people behind you who will always find going to theater maybe just a little bit too expensive and a little bit too indulgent. And I really enjoyed watching this disappointment at how society was changing unfold on stage. I enjoyed watching it take place gradually. I loved watching a play that was about movies that took the opportunity to use the fact that it wasn't a movie to give itself what we would call a non-Hollywood ending, because this doesn't bother ending on an up note, and it doesn't have to because it's a play, and plays really never make as much money as movies do and don't have to appeal to as many people as movies do. So you can actually take the opportunity of this format to say something more profound and less popular with the audiences that might be paying to see it. I have to say, this is probably going to be one of my highlights for the year. And I went out and I bought a script because there were so many things that they talked about that I wanted to read again for on my own time. I highly recommended this show, and when I find the guy who said that I ought to go see it, I'm going to give him a little personal thank you because it seemed to sell out pretty quickly when I managed to get myself a little 15-pound seat on the sides, and that was just great. The only bad thing is you can't sit there and eat popcorn because you are going to want to eat popcorn while you're watching this show. There is nothing more natural.
We're now going to talk about Blue Orange at the Young Vic Theatre. This is Joe Penhall's 2000 play, which was originally done at the Cottesloe, as it was then, back in 2000, with a rather interesting cast, a duet ellagio for Andrew Lincoln and Bill Nighy, who all come on to marvellous things. I think they were pretty good in the original. This production features David Haig, Daniel Kaluuya, and Luke Norris, and is directed by Matthew Cyr. Gareth, could you tell me more about this production and what you thought of it?
Well, as you say, it's 16 years since the premiere of this play back at the National Theatre, and I think this is the first London revival, or certainly the first major London revival since then. So in that sense, it's very welcome. I remember the play with a sort of fondness, really. I remember, it's a play I enjoyed. I must have enjoyed it. I went twice to a couple of friends who were in the mental health world, as it were, to see it the second time I went. And that's what the play is about. It's really about mental health issues with this young Afro-Caribbean boy as the patient in a hospital where we have a senior consultant played by David Haig, character's called Robert, and then a trainee psychiatrist who's called Bruce, who's played by Luke Norris. As I said, I've got sort of fond memories about it. One of the great things about this revival is Jeremy Herbert's done something similar to what he did at the Young Vic for Hamlet, where you have a sort of a particular entrance where you have to walk through a hospital consulting room, not unlike the one that you will then be looking at on the stage in a kind of magical mystery tour to get to your seats. And it's quite a dramatic reconfiguration of the Young Vic because the stage is a kind of island, and then the seating rises in sort of four banks on all sides of the auditorium. And I like that very much. I like the sort of the looking down on events in a kind of fairly voyeuristic way, really. And in the first act of the play, we're at a meeting between this trainee psychiatrist, Bruce, and his patient. And it's the day before his scheduled discharge from hospital. He was sectioned by the police and has been in there for 28 days. And you learn quite quickly that Bruce doesn't believe Chris is ready to leave, but Chris is desperate to go home. And then they're joined by the senior consultant, Robert, who's Bruce's boss, who is the opposite to Bruce. He's very much for discharge. although maybe for reasons other than the patient's well-being, possibly for policy reasons to free up a bed or whatever. So they disagree on the diagnosis. It seems, you know, they're somewhere between borderline personality disorder and schizophrenia, and they argue about this in front of their patient. And we learn things like Bruce has been kind of sucking up to his boss and taking him to rugby and a meal. And Robert is researching into connections between mental health and ethnic origin. It's a very long act, and it's followed immediately without an interval by a second, much shorter act, where we now just have Chris and Robert, so the patient and the senior consultant, in the evening. And that unfolds after the interval into the fact that Bruce's career is now a bit on the line because an investigation has taken place somewhat implausibly rather quickly that morning, although the investigation was also partly to determine the discharge of Chris. And in this third act, they continue to play out their disagreements, the two medics in front of Chris. So it's kind of exploring the motivations of the three characters, really. And obviously there are issues, medical ethics, racism. And my problem with it this time round, and I think that could be a bit of the play, but more of the production, but, you know, maybe I'm wrong, is I just couldn't believe that these two professionals would behave like they do, you know, in front of their patient. And the acting style of David Haig throughout is really very unrestrained and a bit over the top. And then in the third act, Luke Norris mirrors that style as well, and he becomes a bit unrestrained and over the top. And somewhat ironically, Daniel Kaluuya, who plays the patient, is the restrained, subtle performance. And I thought he was absolutely the outstanding performance of the play. You know, it is a very intelligent and very subtle performance, and his sudden switches from sort of funny to manic are really very, very well handled. I thought my problem with it was I just, for this time round, I just couldn't buy it, really. I just couldn't buy the premise that these two doctors were going to behave like this. And if you don't buy that premise, you can't really get involved in it or engage in it. And that was my problem with it. Probably not helped by the fact that the person I was with was visibly not enjoying it either, or rather not enjoying it as much as I was enjoying it. So I left, I'm afraid, a bit disappointed and wished in some ways that I just kind of kept my memory, albeit a fairly shaky one. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, one of the reasons for going to see it is its staging, because I think in terms of the sort of design and staging rather than the acting style, I think that is very good. And of course, this fine performance by this young actor who we've seen a few times now. I think Sucker Punch was one at the Royal Court, and I think he was in Shawnee at the Wells at the Donmar Theatre. He's in Season at the Congo at the Young Vic itself. So, I mean, he's proving to be a very, very fine young actor indeed. And I think is a very good reason for going to see this. But that's where I stand in it. So, Tim, what did you think?
Yeah, I did enjoy it, but to start off with, I was a little bit too influenced by the previous production. I remember it being a lot quieter and a lot more subtle in many ways. I mean, if you think about the actors who were originally in it, they are actors who you think of being very thoughtful and not making an awful lot of noise, and this was much more frenetic. I mean, Daniel Kaluuya, although I agree that he was very good, he was very manic and very energetic towards the start. And I also found a bit of a problem with David Haig's performance, because he did come across a bit too much, almost from the start, as a sort of weak, klutzy kind of person, very much the wrong person to be a boss. And I think that somewhat spoilt the feel for me. The long shadow cast by Bill Nighy, who was a lot smoother initially and a lot more kind and calm, even when he was appearing to get things wrong. Because I think it should really be a battle between these two opposing but almost equally right ways of treating this patient. And there should be a slightly more mystery. You need to be able to defend both positions, I think, in the play, and not really come to a specific conclusion that one person is right and one person is wrong. And I always felt that David Haig's position, because of the way he played it, because of the way he was portrayed as sort of almost incompetent and vengeful and nasty and unpleasant, you never really felt that he was in any way right in what he said. There is a slight thing with this play, which I always amuse people by telling them, well, not that they care. The blue oranges of the title allegedly come from a Tintin book, and in fact there was never a Hergé-drawn book called Tintin and the Blue Oranges. It was in fact a film, and they made a sort of storybook, picture book of the film. And I'm wondering how that got to Africa. I didn't think that, although he's Belgian, and the possibility that he sort of comes from that area of Africa, the sort of the Belgian-controlled places in Africa, I'm not sure that Tintin was de rigueur in there, because Hergé was a little bit racist towards the Africans in some of his books. So I do kind of wonder that it would have taken off there. And it's always been a bit of a problem for me, that the whole thing of the Blue Oranges, it seems to be if not a major part of the film, but it's a major part of the justification that is used for one of the sides in this, and it never really works for me. I mean, of course, you need to know an awful lot about Tintin to get all the subtleties, but it always bothered me. It bothered me 16 years ago. It bothers me now a bit. But overall, I mean, this is very well done. I just think that I really wanted to feel both sides, and that both at some point that both sides were right, and I didn't get that. I got David Haig being too vindictive in many ways, and too scared and frightened of his potential incompetence, and I sort of got that as the reason that he does what he does and is using his power to take revenge on the other Doctor. But overall, I had a pretty good time once I kind of got over the comparisons with the previous production, or my memory of the previous production, and just relaxed into it, let it play out. And it is a very interesting play, and a really, really rather good play. And I think, oddly enough, it's as true today as it was 16 years ago. I don't think we've really made too much progress. I mean, that's one of the things here. It still feels very contemporary, which is probably a bit of a problem. We're now going to talk about Romeo and Juliet, which is the latest Kenneth Branagh Company production at the Garrick Theatre. It stars Richard Madden as Romeo, Lily James as Juliet, and we also have a rather odd person in Derek Jacobi as a rather elderly Mercutio, but I thought he was rather good. What did you think about this play, Phil?
Well, it's funny you mentioned those names, and those were the names that were billed when I booked this. And Romeo and Juliet was my O-level set book, so I know it quite well. And I do like it as a play, as a Shakespeare, and you know, I can have problems with Shakespeare. But actually, the name that was announced afterwards, rather than Derek Jacobi, that intrigued me was Marisa Berenson playing Lady Capula. For me, you know, she will always be the phlegm on the bosom from Cabaret. And it's, you know, now if we have colds, that's how we talk about it. So for me, that suddenly it became very, very interesting. But for me, I found this a really lame production. All right, it was an early preview that I saw, but I felt the verse speaking by quite a few of them was not particularly good. It was a little bit underprojected at first. And actually, I felt there was really no chemistry between Richard Madden and Lily James as Romeo and Juliet. I thought Richard Madden was pretty good, actually. Lily James, not so much. Didn't dislike her. I had a huge problem with the balcony scene, apart from my seat, which meant that I actually couldn't see Richard Madden for about half of the balcony scene. The kind of two steps up balcony kind of was, I found a little bit pathetic, actually. And it was sort of, although the set by Christopher Oram I rather liked, with the sort of the sliding columns coming down, the sort of fascistic kind of Mussolini-esque architecture suggested, because the whole thing's been set in 50s-ish Italy. But this kind of rather cumbersome balcony, which was kind of manhandled on by stagehands, I'm sorry, I found that really rather awkward, considering the design was rather nice. And I felt there was actually that scene absolutely died on its feet. And as a lot of it did for me, you liked Derek Jacobi. I didn't. I found him too camp, a bit too much like the character he plays in Vicious, as though he was sort of warming up for a third series of it. It was an interesting idea to have a much more elderly Mercutio than you normally have. Romeo's sort of best mate is this elderly man who's kind of probably sort of seen it all, done it all, and kind of tutored Romeo. It's probably a long time since Derek Jacobi's done a sword play on stage. but it didn't really work for me at all. The look of it was very stylish. Marisa Berenson, I thought, particularly stylish, the whole thing. I thought she did Grief very well. But I just thought, really, the whole thing was all over the place, completely unengaging. And there was a lot of people walking out when I saw it. People even walked out before the interval. I saw quite a lot leave at the interval, which, given this, you know, playing to full houses, there was house full signs outside, is a bit of a shame. I was really looking forward to this, but I was incredibly disappointed. Mira Sayal is the nurse. Really, the best thing I can say about her is that she made an awful lot of noise in her shoes clumping around the set. The jokes, where they were, fell really absolutely dead on the floor from both Mercutio and Mira Sayal, which for me was quite surprising, particularly from Derek Jacobi. And I just thought it was actually really hadn't come together. It may come together, I don't know, but I thought it was a rather sort of lackluster affair all round. What did you think?
I wasn't entirely satisfied with it either. I do quite like people like Derek Jacobi. It's always fun to see him. And I always like to see Mira Sayal. I found that Richard Madden was a little bit underpowered for me. He sort of sold it, but I didn't really get that he was in the same play as everybody else, which is a little bit odd for me. Lily James, I thought, was okay. I mean, she did feel young enough in it, so it did feel like that sort of ingenue quality to her. But yes, I mean, it didn't feel a terribly strong play, and I agree with you about the set. They seem to have wanted this sort of cafe culture palazzo that they're in with all these columns, and it didn't really... It was a bit stuffed together and not really, you know, it's sort of almost as if they wanted a cafe culture throughout it, as if it's always done in this sort of open-air cafe. The entire play's being done there, and it didn't really work that well for me. We also have the rather odd replacement of the apothecary with another of the sort of the servants who suddenly apparently wants to kill herself. And there's lots of rather odd bits in this production, and yeah, it was a little bit disappointing, a little bit, you know, underpowered, I think is the best word for it.
Now, I think the reason why Lily James seems young enough is because Marisa Berenson, who's playing her mother, is 69, although she looks damn sight younger than that on stage. I kind of almost could forgive Marisa Berenson anything. It was just great to see her on stage. Derek Jacobi is always a pleasure to see him on stage, but I felt with this it was really not working at all, and I felt that actually was true of the rest of the production. I did actually quite like Richard Madden. I do sort of feel I never really believed in the passion of it, and I felt it was sort of going a bit through by rote as though it was sort of doing the scenes. I think, you know, the balcony scene is probably the most famous scene from it, and that, to me, needed an awful lot of work. It might be something that comes together. I kind of feel not. I got, you know, we were talking to other people in the audience who were, well, the ones who hadn't left. And the stage that I saw it at, people were actually being much less generous than me. I'm kind of reining in a little bit because we're talking about it online. Derek Jacobi's Queen Mab speech, to be honest, was just vicious Queen Mab speech. It just was... I felt a little bit embarrassed, to be honest.
One of our regular contributors, Web Cowgirl, has been dipping her feet, into the world of playwriting. She had a play called Christmas Carol on at the Old Red Lion for a few evenings at the end of last year, towards Christmas. And she has got another play on at the Theatre N16, which is confusingly at the Bedford Inn in Balham, on 29th of May through to the 1st of June. I think most of the people who contribute to the podcast are writers of a sort, and some of us even dabble in a little bit of fiction. So, Web Cowgirl, your play, we probably aren't allowed to review it because you're a regular contributor and it's not actually fair, but could you tell us a little bit about this play and what you drove you towards it? It's called Three Brothers. That obviously suggests a possible sort of take on Chekhov of some description. But can you tell us a little bit more about it and how you came to think of this idea and write it?
Well, the inspiration was actually from a conversation that I had with my oldest uncle. My dad's family, at my dad's generation, consists of three boys, the three brothers of the play, my father being the middle one. And my uncle was talking to me about going back to Kansas every winter to look after his auntie and how exhausting the whole experience is. And apparently the reason why it's exhausting is because when he goes back to Kansas, he stays with his brothers. The two of them live next door to each other, but one of them has a spare bedroom. And so that's where my uncle stays. And it is staying with the family that is the most exhausting and horrible thing about the trip, and the reason why he's so burnt out when he makes it back to where he lives, which is in Munich. And I said, well, Frank, why don't you just rent a room so that you have a place to stay where you can have some peace and time to yourself? And he said, I would never do that. That room is mine by rights, and there's not a reason why I should spend a penny more to be anywhere else. And I thought, my God, you sound like one of those foolish people in a Chekhov play that has such an easy answer in front of them, but just can't do it because you're too stubborn. And then I thought about it some more, and I was like, oh my God, they're all like Chekhov characters, the three of them, the three old men who are forced to spend so much time together and they can't stand each other, but they're too cheap to do anything else. And I'm like, but it's not that they're all so cheap because, well, you know, like my dad, he sort of has this bizarre vision about, you know, what does it mean to be family and, you know, heritage and all of these sort of like, you know, crazy romantic notions. And then, you know, my other uncle, I think he just stays there just because he's cheap and he's trying to turn a buck. It's not the same kind of cheapness. It's just like it's part of his whole scheme. He's always got a scheme going. And I was like, God, it's like they are like characters in a play. And I thought, how can I take these three men who are grown men and yet I find still can't let go of any of the petty rivalries of their childhood? Can I take this and turn it into a play? And I started thinking about it and came up with a situation about, basically, I wanted them to have one of those kind of Chekhov endings where, you know, basically because you don't do the smart thing, then something really horrible happens to you. I wanted to have an ending like that. And as it turns out, in some ways, there's parallels between this play and The Cherry Orchard. But the play itself is wholly original. You know, there's no debt collectors. There's no sound of a tree being chopped in the background. And I've decided to use it as an opportunity, because I've been living here for so long, to kind of celebrate what it's like to be in the Midwest, to talk about the kind of things that people talk about there, to tell jokes about family and friends, to have people just, you know, acting, I think, really normal. But in this case, normal, but like they should have maybe all gone to therapy when they were in their 20s or 30s, and none of them did. I think British people will recognize the types that these men are, because the characters themselves, like, they speak in the voice of real people, but their motivations, their drives, they've been like clarified and distilled so that they make better characters, so that they're, you know, more fun to read and more fun to have them play off against each other. But the characters and their motivations are, I think, very recognizable to British people. And also, I've found as I've been explaining to the actors what the motivations are, that the Midwesterners in America frequently don't talk about anything emotional whatsoever. So there are references to relationships that these three men have, their relationships with their mother, their relationship with romantic partners. They know that these relationships exist, but they never say anything about how they feel about them. Never, never, never. And I was questioned, oh, why aren't, you know, why isn't this character moaning and groaning about this? Why aren't they getting into this? Why is nobody saying, oh, you know, that's really tragic. How are you feeling? But in fact, in this society, especially with men, you would just never ask those questions. So I think that English people will find the characters familiar and some of the situations familiar and maybe be surprised by the similarities with this culture. But I think getting to see this life in Kansas and life in a kind of close family environment brought to life on stage will, I think, be novel and fun. And even though, you know, there's a certain grimness to the situation of these three men who in their 60s are now desperately trying to get their lives together, looking forward to not having very much money. And if you know anything about America, having health insurance suddenly become a really big issue for them and worrying about their future and where they're going to wind up. The play is just full of comedy, and basically it's a chance for us to sit down, watch these guys behave to some extent like idiots, have a good laugh, and then go home promising yourself that you're never going to act like that yourself. So I had this idea for a story, but I've thought about, you know, should I actually put this play on? Do I really want to see it on stage? And there's a quote from Stephen King where he was talking at a graduation or a conference or something. And he said, for every writer, there is one book that becomes your reason for becoming a writer. And you'll know that you have that book when you close it and you say to yourself, by God, I could write something better than that. And I've been going to see probably about 120, 150 plays a year for the last 10 years. And I have seen a lot of good plays, fair amount of bad plays, and I have some idea of what makes a good night at the theater, according to my taste, of course. And I can promise you there are many plays on stage that this play is better than. And I can also promise you that it's just about 1 hour long. And at 1 hour, I find I am much more forgiving about what I watch. My hope is that somebody will pick this play up and the longer version of it that I cut it down will make it on stage. But for right now, I thought, let's pull people in, give them a nice evening where they go home and they think about the characters that they saw and they think about some of the language. And they think, yeah, that was pretty good. And that they want to see more and like they want to see more stuff that I wrote.
Cool. Thanks. I don't have any other questions. I think you answered everything. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page of Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.